Acts 4, verse 1. The priests and the captains of the temple guard and the Sadducees came up to Peter and John while they were speaking to the people. They were greatly disturbed because the apostles were teaching the people, proclaiming Jesus' resurrection of the dead. They seized Peter and John, and because it was evening, they put them in jail until the next day. Many who heard the message believed, so the number of men who believed grew to about 5,000. Okay, hands up those who heard me misread that passage. One, two, three, four. I did. I misread it. I'll do it again for you. Look carefully. The priest and the captain of the temple guard and the Sadducees came up to Peter and John while they were speaking to the people. They were greatly disturbed because the apostles were teaching the people, proclaiming Jesus' resurrection of the dead. They seized Peter and John, and because it was evening, they put them in jail until the next day. But many who heard the message believed, so the number of men who believed grew to be about 5,000. Hands up those who heard me misread it the second time, not the first time. We're getting there. Hands up those who haven't heard it misread yet. That's all right, that's all right. We're still a couple who can't hear. Sorry?
You misread it differently.
Yeah, I misread it differently. Yep. No. The key lies, of course, in verse 2. I kept leaving two words out. The word in and the word the. They were teaching the people, proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection of the dead. Yes, they were preaching Jesus' resurrection from the dead. That's why you were happy to let my misread pass over, because that's true. But it's not actually what the text is saying. You've missed it. Now, there was a clue to that misreading. There was a clue that should have warned you straight off front. What was the clue given to you in verse 1 about this?
Sadducees,
that's right. See, the Sadducees, what are they famous for? Not believing in the resurrection. They didn't believe in the resurrection before Jesus was resurrected. Because the resurrection is something different to Jesus' resurrection. Right? The resurrection is what you need to understand, rather than, and what Peter and John were preaching was the resurrection happening in Jesus. That when Jesus rose from the dead, he commenced the resurrection from the dead. Well, of course the Sadducees were unhappy with that. They didn't believe in the resurrection. That's why they are Sadducee. Easy to remember. Taught that in Sunday school. It's one of the few lessons I actually have got. They were Sadducee. Now, that just shows the importance of reading, to make sure you are seeing and preaching what the text is saying. But let's look a little bit further in terms of the questions. You see, you don't understand something because the text is obscure, is not the reason. The reason is your assumptions are wrong. Some years ago, Helen and I went to dinner with a Christian friend who had a rabbi friend, and the rabbi was telling us about the Revised Standard Version, which he did not like. He said, "Well, your Revised Standard Version, that's dreadful." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, down the bottom it keeps saying the Hebrew is unclear." He said, "The Hebrew is never unclear. You are unclear about what it means, but it is perfectly clear." And that, I'm afraid, is the problem. Yes, there are, according to the Apostle Peter, some things that Paul wrote which are difficult to understand. But basically, they're not. Basically, the difficulty is not in the text, but in the old noggin. That I have certain assumptions that mean I don't understand what the text is saying. And so what I then do is twist the text to fit my assumptions, rather than challenge my assumptions by what the text is saying. And so, what does it mean about in the resurrection? Well, what's the resurrection? Ezekiel 37, the valley of dry bones. The promise is that in the age to come, life is going to come back to the people of Israel, and they're going to be resurrected. Daniel chapter 12 again speaks of the resurrection, which is going to happen in the last days. John chapter 5 in verse 26 following there about the resurrection coming. It's the resurrection is coming when all who are dead and in the graves will rise again. I mean, this is the dispute between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, which Paul, remember, exploited when he's in trial in Jerusalem at the end of the book of Acts. He sees that the Sanhedrin is made up of Sadducees and Pharisees, and so he says, I'm standing here for the Pharisees because of the resurrection. I believe in the resurrection. And so the Sadducees then are against him, but the Pharisees now come and defend him because, as a Christian, we're on the Pharisaic side of this question. Well, think of John 11. You know, when Jesus, Lazarus has died because Jesus took some time to come. And when he does come, Martha rebukes him. You know, if you had been here, Lord, my brother would not have died. And Jesus said, your brother will rise again. Now, what does Martha say next? She says, I
know he will rise again.
Yeah, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection. I mean, the Jewish belief was God's people will rise again in the resurrection. So when Jesus says, don't worry, you'll rise again, she'll say, yeah, but that doesn't sort out my problem with my brother dying. I mean, of course he's going to rise again. He was a good, godly man. And then Jesus says, I am the resurrection. A stark, kind of weird phrase to be saying at that point. But I am the resurrection. Believe in me and you'll not die, and those who die will rise again. Do you believe in me? And she professes her faith in the Christ. But the whole thing doesn't make sense if you don't understand the Jewish background of the resurrection, the biblical background of the resurrection. The little conversation doesn't work. Or in Luke 14, it talks about don't invite people to dinner who can invite you back, but invite other people who can't invite you back, because you will be rewarded in the resurrection. That's where you get your reward. We talk about dying and going to heaven. The New Testament says dying and rising again. Don't mishear me. I'm not denying the reality of heaven. I'm just saying the way of the New Testament talks is the resurrection. And so what Peter and John were preaching was the resurrection has come in Jesus. Now that he has risen from the dead, he's the first fruit of the resurrection, as Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 15. So, seeing the little phrase there, in Jesus' resurrection, is the thing that should help you to go searching. That is, you read properly and you come to questions. This text does not make sense. Why is it saying what it's saying? Well, it does make sense. You don't make sense. You have to change your mind. Now, a lot of preachers run away from the difficult bits that they don't understand, and hey, you don't get in the pulpit to explain your ignorances. That's fair enough. But on the other hand, that's where I see the difficulties is where I really rejoice. I'm never worried about seeing difficulties in the text. I think that's fantastic. Because if there's a difficulty, that means I'm not thinking straight. And this is the chance to straighten my thinking. So rather than, oh, this is hard, I go the opposite direction. This is the good bit. Now, that's a simple one for you to pick up, but there are lots of others. And if you're doing your work in the Greek text, and I don't know how many of you are theologically educated and have been taught your Greek or not, if you haven't, keep teaching the Bible. Right? Don't feel I can't teach the Bible, I haven't learned Greek. You go for it. But if you have, then get your Greek out and work at it. Because when you look at the Greek, you often find the translations are an attempt to smooth it over. Smooth over the problems that are there. And I found digging where the problems are is where I actually come to understand the scriptures better. It's a benefit for me. 1 Peter 2:8. Is it 8? It talks about Noah and seven others being rescued. But that's not actually what the Greek says. The Greek says Noah, the eighth preacher of righteousness. Now, I can think of Noah and seven others because Mrs. Noah, three boys, three wives, there you go, there's eight people. But if he wanted to say that, he would have said it, but he didn't say that. He called Noah the eighth preacher of righteousness. Why? Now, our translators don't know why, so that's why they mistranslated it. They're good people trying to help us the best they can. But it's not what the text is saying. So days and days of worrying. Sometimes the sermon has passed before I've actually sorted it out, right? Days and days of wondering and worrying. But then, I mean, one of the problems is Noah never preaches. He builds an ark, but he never preaches. So why is he called a preacher of righteousness, let alone the eighth? And who are the other seven? Right? And all very weird to me. But the answer is back in Genesis 5, when from the age of Seth, I think it is, they started to proclaim the name of the Lord. And you count the generations from there, and Noah is the eighth one in the list. And so he's actually referring to Noah properly from his Genesis background. You can have it freely. I haven't written it up, although I think my son has produced an article in some obscure journals to the same effect. Right? But it's digging where the text is problematical for you or for the translator. Is reading carefully, properly, not what you think it's going to say, but what it actually does say. Right? And the questions, I think, are critical. Then let me introduce you to your friends. You want to ask a question this stage? You're happy? I'm proceeding? Well, just stop me when you want. Right? Friends. I've got several friends. And these are in, I think, order of importance. First friend, I mean, Jesus is my friend, yes, but humanly speaking, first friend is the concordance. Concordances are very, very important. Do you know how dictionaries, dictionaries never define a word? Have you got out of the dictionary definition? Because dictionaries don't define words. What dictionaries do is they describe how words are used. They're descriptive, not definitive. And how do they know how words are used? Well, they look up every usage of the word. And then they sit down and think out, what does it mean in this context? What does it mean? And just put in the word, change the word to X, read the sentence with an X in. What does it mean? And then after looking at all the usages, they come and say, well, it's used in three different ways or four different ways. That's their exercise. For most of you, you haven't got time to do anything about it. Stick with the dictionary, etc. But for those of you who have been taught your Greek and Hebrew, and you really can, and especially when you come to a question, problem question that you can't sort out, your concordance is your best friend. Go back to the concordance and look up every reference. That's the way they did it. That's the way you need to do it to actually get a feel for how the word was used in other contexts. to give you a range of possibilities as to what it could mean in the context that's right in front of you. So a concordance is a great friend. It's such a great friend that I actually bought into computers in 1999 because I started to see the accordance program on the Mac things, and I could see that they could do things better than the books. Now, of course, we all just use computers. I had to re-educate myself in my midlife to do that. But there are some wonderful computer programs now available. I still find the accordance one quite a good one. Second great help is cross-references. They are phenomenal help. In the back of a lot of Greek New Testaments, there is a list of cross-references and allusions. The cross-references are quotations, direct quotations. Allusions are, it sounds like, but we can't prove it word for word. And good ones will give you cross-references from Old Testament to New Testament, organised by Old Testament passages, and then Old Testament to New Testament, organised by New Testament passages. So this Bible that I have here, from picked up from the church there, is an excellent pew Bible, but a completely useless study Bible. No cross-references. Good cross-reference system is really vital. The ESV has the old Revised Version cross-reference system imposed upon it. The Revised Version of 1880 was done by three Cambridge scholars, Wetfoot, Lightfoot and Hort, and that has the most thorough, best cross-reference system that anyone has ever come up with. It's very, very good. Easier to do it in the non-dynamic equivalence translations. If that's just over your head, don't worry about it, but if you understand what I mean, the difference, because a dynamic equivalence translation translates ideas for ideas rather than words for words, and so you can't get cross-references of the words properly. But the cross-references are just vital. Every time the New Testament refers to the Old Testament, if you're going to preach on that passage, you've got to go back and read not just that verse, but the passage that verse is in and what it was about, to be able to understand what is being said in the New Testament. So cross-references, my second favourite friend. My third friend is the dictionary. There's all kinds of dictionaries around that are good. I was given, when I was 21st birthday present, I think it was, the New Bible Dictionary. Next to the Bible, I think it's the book I've read the most. It's a terrific summary. It's 1,000 pages with very useful articles on pretty well anything you ever want to ask about the Bible. I find it very helpful, but there's lots of others. And there are dictionaries of theology. Jim Packer wrote a short dictionary of theology. That's worth having. Another one is a book by Jim Packer called God's Words. It's a very good little book. You pick a word like sanctification, he'll give you three pages explaining what it means and showing you where it occurs in the scriptures with great accuracy. And it's each of the articles is only two or three pages long. But pure gold, the summaries that he has there. So dictionaries I find helpful. The fourth friend, I've only got five, apart from my wife and the Lord Jesus. The fourth friend is the commentaries. And commentaries are like AI. You've got to learn how to use it, but beware, it's very dangerous. The academic commentaries are hopeless and useless, because for the academics to progress in their career, they have to write books that demonstrate they've read everything. And so they tell you everything that everybody has ever said but they don't tell you what the Bible is saying. Mm-hmm. And so they're an exhibition, they're a show-off of their thorough scholarship, which doesn't help. I was preaching on Philippians 2, 5 to 11, that wonderful, wonderful passage of Paul. And I pulled down my commentary, and there were 80 pages of discussions of every phrase, every bit. And to actually read, understand, comprehend and follow everything, it was going to take most of the week just to read that commentary. And I'm supposed to get up next Sunday and preach a sermon. And how could I possibly remember all the discussions? It just is a useless book. It was a good book to consult for the problem text. So what am I going to do with Hapagmos? Am I going to take it as this way or that way? So I look up that commentary on Hapagmos, but I wouldn't bother about reading all the way through those pages. That's just... And there's a commentary on Luke's Gospel by Howard Marshall, a great Bible-believing Christian brother, huge and fat thing. And it never tells you anything about Luke's Gospel, but it tells you everything about everything anybody has ever written about Luke's Gospel.
About the Greek text.
About the Greek text of the Luke's Gospel. And a friend of mine went to a great preacher in England, Dick Lucas. He was calling in on Dick's place. And as he walked into the study, he saw that Howard Marshall's commentary resided in the waste paper basket. And that's pretty well where it deserves to be. There are some great commentaries on Luke's Gospel that are available, but the one that's a commentary on commentaries is not a commentary on the text. And I've read commentaries for the last 50, 60 years. It's part of my life. But it's like AI. The good there is there is also swallowed up by the bad that is there. So you need to be careful in how you read, which ones you read and what you get from them. And then my fifth friend is the internet, because it's just so fast. It's just so quick at finding out answers for me, especially answers about the world. Because if you're going to preach the Christian worldview, you've got to negate the non-Christian worldview. Well, the internet will tell me the non-Christian worldview very quickly. To that end, I read the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian, which are two newspapers. One's on the right wing, one's on the left wing, and they're both hopeless. But I read them because they help me understand what stupidity Australians are going on with at the moment. And because I like playing off against each other. So they're my friends. Other friends that you have that you'd like to mention? That you've found helpful or useful?
Yes, the pastor. Pastor at church.
The pastor at church, yes. Hey, philipjensen.com. There's a friend. Hey. With philipjensen.com, I'd encourage you to prepare your own sermon first and then listen to one of the great ones or available ones. Because if you listen to somebody else's, you don't think it out for yourself. You tend to just absorb and reproduce, modify it. No, you want to think out, this is what I'm going to do. Now I'll check up. And I listened to the other person, I said, oh, gee, I haven't thought of that aspect. Yes, I could tie that into my point three. Or I say, oh, yes, now that I hear that, I haven't understood it at all. I better go back to the drawing board. I'm moving on. Prayer. Well, that's one of the topics everyone agrees with, but nobody knows what they're agreeing with. You know the word prayer? There's seven words for prayer, I think it is, in the New Testament. I wrote a book on prayer some years ago. There's seven words. They all mean the same thing, ask. That's why the New Testament always says, pray with thanksgiving, because thanksgiving is not asking. So thanksgiving is not prayer. Thanksgiving is something you do when you pray, because you ask God for things, well, you've got to thank him for the things he's given you. So you thank God, but you pray with thanksgiving. It's a kind of funny phrase that you don't notice till you hear it. And when you hear it, you'll see it over and over again. What do I ask God for? Well, I'm asking God to open my mind to understand. And I'm asking him to help me to see not only how I've understand it, but how I can communicate it to others. I'm asking that others may hear and understand what I'm saying. And so prayer is not simply talking to God. There's nothing wrong with talking to God. It's just not what prayer is. Prayer is asking for things. Asking for things is not rude. Asking for things is not kind of a shopping list of self-centeredness. No, no. When you ask God for something, you are declaring, one, that he is powerful because he can give you whatever it is you're asking, and two, he is loving and gracious and generous and would want to give it to you. Remember, God is our Father. Asking God for things is treating your father as a father. Provide for me. Protect me. That's what fathers do. And so asking is honouring God. Not. And so you ask God to help you in praying. Number five, aim. Well, this is a key part of preparation. It's to determine the aim. The first aim is, what is the aim of this passage? What is the writer trying to communicate? So I've been dealing with 1 Corinthians 14 recently. I'm not going to go into all this. But people have a big problem with 1 Corinthians 14, the end bit of it, because... No, they have problems all the way through. But they have problems at the end bit of it because there seems to be a conflict between the teaching about women at the end of chapter 14 and the teaching of women in chapter 11. And so that's what they preach about and how they resolve this seeming contradiction. 1 Corinthians 14 is not about that. 1 Corinthians 14... is about order in the church. Now, the women's issue is but a sideline issue, an illustration of the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing is about, in church, you are to conduct things in accordance with the character of God, who is not a God of chaos, but a God of order and decency. And so it's about the importance of order in the church. But because my mind is fixated on what am I going to do with this and women and what do you say about women in the world today and women in Christian ministry, you've got all these questions, you miss the aim of the passage. My aim is not to answer those questions until I've worked out what the passage itself is talking about. That's the aim of the passage is the aim of the sermon, not the questions I may or may not have. You'll notice, for example, I'm not answering that question now. I'm not talking about women and preaching or how you connect those two things now, because my aim is to get you to understand the aim of the passage is more important than your questions. And so I've illustrated that by saying this passage is about decency and order in church. Now, what do I know about that? And what am I going to say about that? Right, so second aim. First aim is what's the aim of the passage so that I can communicate that. Second aim is how do I communicate that same message to hearers? That is, you must never teach the Bible and you must never preach the Bible. You must always preach and teach the Bible to people. When you ask a teacher, what do you teach? This is a crass illustration, but you get the point. When you ask what do they teach? If they say, I teach chemistry or I teach French, they're not very good teachers. If they say, I teach young people, they're good teachers. But the person who teaches chemistry hasn't done anything. You've got to teach chemistry to people. That's why primary school teachers are so good, you see, because they know what they're doing. They're teaching little children. It's quite obvious. But once we start specialising away, we start teaching the Bible. No, I teach people the Bible, or I teach the Bible to people. And so in that, there's a whole set of issues. There's a difference between the speaker and the hearer. I've spent theological training, then years doing this, and I've spent the whole of this week preparing this passage. The hearers just rocked up to church. Really helpful if I can tell them which passage I'm going to preach on so they read it before they get there. That will improve their comprehension massively. But they've just rocked up. Now, I've got to work out how to download this information in my head, which is vastly more than I could possibly do, into people who have almost nothing in their head. There's a difference then between the close reading of Scripture, which will deal with every jot and tittle, and the brief reading of Scripture, which will get the fundamental message. How do I work out enough of the detail to get the message across accurately, but not so many details that they can't hear the message? There's the difference between the false assumptions the hearers have when they're coming to the Scriptures. Now, I know sometimes my false assumptions, because I've cleared it up, but mine are not necessarily theirs, and I don't necessarily know what theirs are. So I've got to work out. Now, there are some that are generally true. Australians, by and large, think that Christianity teaches good people go to heaven and bad people don't. That's a basic Australian assumption. I'm speaking to an Australian congregation. I can generally think that's what they think. It's worth a try. But I don't know. And that's why pastoral preaching is easier than itinerant preaching. The easiest people to preach are the people whom God has given you to love. Because if you really love them as God has given them to you to love, you'll get to know them. As you get to know them, you'll get to understand their false assumptions, their worldviews, and so you can then tailor which aspect of the Bible learning you've done to address the kinds of assumptions that will stop them from understanding the passage because of how they think. Now, see, I don't like contextualization, because I'm trying to change them in their context. And deculturalization, that doesn't work for me. It's more a translation I'm working at. The idea that the ideas of this passage are the ideas that I want them to understand, comprehend, so they can make godly decisions. But that's where I have a fight with the translators, because the translators have the same idea, and so they have these dynamic equivalence translations which try and solve the problems that they see in the text for the hearers. And so I find where I'm preaching, I've got to use different translations. So if I'm working in a university congregation, I use the ESV because it's not modern English. It's translated English. No one actually speaks like the ESV. Well, some people do, but they're rather strange. It's just not normal modern English. But it's not meant to be. It's meant to be translated English. So from it, you've got a better sense of what's actually in the Greek and the Hebrew behind it. But I was speaking to the average man in the street of Australia. I think the New International Version is better, because it goes from idea to idea rather than word to word. And it's beautiful modern English. Modern educated English. if you're actually speaking to younger people or speaking to people who have very poor education, then I'm going to move to another translation, the old one we used to use with the Good News Bible, which was translated for the Eskimos, who didn't have English as their first language. And then we discovered that actually it was about the level of education of the average Australian, which tells you something about us, doesn't it? Now, I don't know, up here, with the multiplicities of your cultural settings, I don't know what translations you use for people cross-culture, but you do need to move into that, because each time it creates a different preaching issue for you, doesn't it? Very easy to preach from the ESV and know that what you're saying is what is there, but you've just got to make sure people understand it. Whereas other ones, yes, they'll understand it. It doesn't quite actually mean what's being said. But I don't want to say that because I don't want to undermine their confidence in their Bible. It's a problem preachers face wherever you are in the range of translations. I hate it when I say, look, the Greek doesn't mean that. Because that says, unless you've done Greek, you can't read your Bible. I don't want to say that to people. That's a dreadful thing to say. So unless I absolutely have to say it, I won't say it. Because it just is, the long-term consequences are not worth the short-term gain. So I just press on and ignore the errors. But I think for those of us who are properly trained in the first place, it is responsible for us to know more Greek at the end of our ministry years than we did when we started. And I'm afraid that's not what people do. But in my great preaching years, I started each week translating the passage that I was going to preach on before I looked at the English text, so as to keep my Greek up to date and improved, and so as to be actually dealing with the text that was there before I looked at the way the translators took the text and then looked at how the commentaries took the text, but that's, I think, is basic Christian minister responsibility. For those who haven't studied it, you don't necessarily understand that it is impossible to translate from one language to another with 100% comprehension accuracy. So all translations, the Muslims are funny about this because they're actually right, but they're funny. They say you can't read the Quran in anything other than Arabic because all other English, etc., are interpretations, not translations. And there's a certain sense that that's true. The Latin was a good translation when it was done, a long time ago. But translations lay at the root of the Reformation. It was because the Greek was flowing down through the River Cam into Cambridge that they sat around and read their Greek texts that they saw the Latin was wrong in the White Horse Hotel in Cambridge. It was Luther, bless him, who translated it into German. It was Tyndale who translated it into English. At the root of the Reformation was translation, was getting the Bible right. May I say, by the way, the King James Version is a better translation than most people give credit. The trouble with the King James Version is, one, they didn't have many texts. They had something like 27 texts to translate on. We have 5,000. And two, it's Elizabethan English. So nowadays you need to translate from the Elizabethan English into modern English, so it's a double translation to get there. But actually, when I'm in the middle of confrontations and struggles with my mind as to how best to translate it, I look up the King James and I think, you know what? That was pretty good, really. it had in part the fact that it was a period of time when the scholars were passionate for knowing what it said rather than for defending their theological position. Whereas today they're all touched a little bit by defending their theological position. Yet Bible translation's a problem for preachers. I'm saying, once you and the congregation have got a translation, preach it. And it depends which kind of congregation as to which kind of Bible to use, really. I may say that another one that I find very often to my liking is J.N. Darby, of all people, the Brethren translation, which has got considerable concern for accuracy. Yes?
You said we quote by the aim. You want to understand the aim of the passage. And then you sort of very quickly said that should be the aim of the sermon, and you went on to point two. I've heard at different times, sometimes people want to say that the aim of the passage may not necessarily be the aim of the sermon.
Okay. My basic preaching pattern and program is expositional preaching. In expositional preaching, the aim of the passage should be the aim of the sermon. When you do a topical sermon, then the aim of the sermon is addressing the topic you're addressing. It may use different passages, but when it uses those passages, it must do so with an acknowledgement, with an understanding of the aim of the passage in its context. So, otherwise you wind up using the text rather than answering the topic from the text. 95% of the preaching I did and have done was expositional. We've done Mark 1, now let's look at Mark 2. And therefore the aim of Mark 2 and what Mark is trying to say in chapter 2 is what I'm going to try and say today. Whatever that may be. I remember coming to 1 Corinthians 8 and thinking, food offered to idols. Who in this congregation could possibly be interested in food offered to idols, etc.? Was I wrong? Chapters 8, 9, 10 were some of the most lively discussions with our congregational life, to say nothing, of course, of the overseas students who had idols at their homes and actually had food left aside for the ancestors, etc. It was all over. Leaving aside that, a whole subject of freedom and it just was terrific. But when I opened it up the first day to my sinfulness, I said, well, really? What's this? So expositional preaching gets me speaking on things that they're not my agenda. They're God's agenda. And takes me to subjects and areas that I wouldn't normally think of. But my aim is to say its aim. I had a great friend in America, Kent Hughes, who followed the same pattern. We became great friends because we thought so much alike, not having met each other until we were in our 50s or 60s. And Kent always did the same thing. But when 9/11 happened, for the first time in his ministry in Wheaton, he spoke on the topic because the whole nation was traumatised by 9/11, and he spoke for 3 weeks on the topics. And he said the congregation were enormously helped by this. And I said, yes, of course they were, because they'd been fed the scriptures, so that when you refer to the scriptures, they know what the scriptures are saying, and therefore your logic of topical preaching makes sense. But if you're just preaching topics all the time, they never know their scriptures. They can't evaluate your topics. So I'm assuming you know lots of the scriptures. So I told you about John 11 and Martha. If you've never read what I said, how do you know I've got it right? You know, I mean, I have, but I'm just alluding to it. But if you come to an uneducated congregation, biblically uneducated, topical preaching is disastrous. You've got to do expositional preaching. That's the bread and butter every week teaching of the Word of God, to which then, when there are moments of topics, you can actually take a topic and do it. That's worth doing. I'm moving on. Aim. I'm still under aim, which is point five. Translation. The third aim is to summarise my talk's aim into a single sentence. Here is still under preparation. What am I aiming to do? I've got to find the aim of the passage. I'm trying to work out how to communicate it. Well, I come to the point where I can summarise what I'm trying to do in a single sentence. That sentence is never, my aim is to expound this passage. That's not an aim. I'm talking about the aim of this sermon. And this sermon's aim is something that, my aim is that the congregation understands that X is the truth and that Y is not the truth. And that there can be changes in their practice or something. Once I have that aim worked out in a single sentence, then point six, I can do the outline. For me, these are the kinds of outlines I've always done. It's enough to keep the congregation along. I'm point six. For some reason, the number has been dropped out of outline and seven's been chopped. Anyway, point six, the outline. It's enough to keep the line of the logic. It's enough to be able to call people back if their mind has drifted off, right? But the aim means that I have a direction and purpose to teach, and then I find the key points needed to arrive at that aim. And these will be logically developed, and this will explain those parts of the text that are necessary for you to understand the text and its aim. And so the aim will be to remove obstacles in hearers' minds, sometimes physical obstacles like, the heat or whatever it might be, but sometimes it's more often it's the intellectual ones, to get everybody on board by asking a question at the beginning to get them thinking in the area that we want to answer, that will satisfactorily be answered at the conclusion, because people... Gestaltian psychology is right. Dum, da da dum, dum, dum is really irritating, isn't it? You want completion. That's the way our brains function. So you have the completion. And then I'm trying to find illustrations that will help understanding. Illustrations that will help understanding, that's all. They're not applications, they're illustrations I'm interested in. Then comes the cutting floor. That is, because I think by talking, I have a danger of saying too much. Writing is one of the ways to control it, but reading written sermons is bad, because listening and talking is a different language than writing and reading. They're two different languages. I write books with friends. I've only ever written one book purely by myself, and then I've had three different editors trying to solve the problems that I created by writing. But I write books with Tony Payne. He writes the books. I don't write the books. Just about to produce another book. His name's not in front of it, but he did a lot of work for me again. That's because I'm a preacher and I've spent my life writing sermons. And so I write spoken English. That spoken English, when put on a page as a book, is dreadful. Really, it just does not work. Written English works for readers. But when you read out loud written English, it doesn't work. They're just two different forms of language to be used. And so I write sermons so as to control my language, but the written sermon is bad, so I preach it out loud in the study and I lay it out in dot points. This is the main point, this is the next point, this is the next point. So I don't write it out as paragraphs, because when I write it as paragraphs, I read it. When I write it as points, I don't read it. I glance and look and speak to the people. And so It's a way of overcoming, but practice talking is important, and talking in talk language, not written language, is important. But when you've finished it, you look at your best illustration, you look at your best turn of phrase, you look at the one that really you love most of all, and throw it away. Because it's nearly always over the top and useless. It'll swallow up your sermon, it'll destroy it. I started a sermon once telling the story of my last day when I was 21, my last conversation with my mother when she died, and how I went to the nursing home where she was, and how we resolved our little conflict with each other as she lay dying. And you know what? Nobody heard another word of the sermon. It was totally useless illustration, because it just overwhelmed people. I had them in tears. I didn't hear them listening to God. They just heard this moving account of Philip's mother dying, and I won't give it to you because it's, even now I'll distract you with it, right? The very best illustrations generally need to wind up on the cutting floor. Come on, we've got a few minutes left for questions. I want to ask comments.
I'm thinking about the aim of the passage is the aim of the sermon again. And I think it's helpful. I think we know what you mean, and that's good. But I also think it could be quite problematic. You're thinking, if I figure out the writer's name in this passage, who's the writer? Because the Holy Spirit is involved as well as the human author. What's the passage? Because we choose how we break up our pericopes and preach them in a sermon series. Yeah, and if the aim of the passage was, the point is that perhaps there'll be a quite obvious aim that could never be the aim of a sermon. So, feel free to address any of those issues I'm raising.
Yeah.
I'll look forward to your answer.
I can qualify that straight away, yes. The aim of the prophets was to tell you about the sufferings and glories of the Christ, but they didn't understand what they were talking about. So in one sense, I'm not interested in their aim. I'm interested in the aim that God had for that passage to be written. That's why, in a sense, Old Testament preaching is a little bit more difficult, because you've got to read your Old Testament as Christian literature. And therefore, the aim God has for the Old Testament passage is found in the New Testament. Now, the beauty, I'm sorry, I don't know who's here, but for those of you who are Anglicans, the beauty of the Anglican liturgy used to be, one of the great beauties was, you read both Old and New Testaments. You didn't just read one, because that's the right way to read the Bible. If you're a Baptist, can I encourage you to take up this aspect of Anglicanism, right? Because it's the right way to do it. That is, God has written to us in two testaments. And you can't understand the New Testament without the Old, and you can't understand the Old Testament without the New. Therefore, you need to keep having both read, and the preaching of the aim of the passage in the Old is going to be a little bit more a step through processes than taking from the New. But I still want to know, what was God's aim in giving us Psalm 137? So that I'll say what Psalm 137 is saying, and not say what Two Ways to Live says loosely attached to Psalm 137, or whatever it might be. And that means that there are some parts of the Bible where I will be preaching messages which are fairly negative and strong. The balanced diet of the churchgoer is best guarded by the gospel and by the scriptures than it is by the mind of the preacher. I don't preach what I think they need to hear. I preach Mark's gospel. Now, in a sense, I'm still going to choose. Why am I preaching Mark's gospel? Why am I preaching Matthew? Why am I preaching Luke? I used to work with a great man. Derek is fantastic. Oh, I love Derek. He said, one gospel, every series, one gospel, one epistle, then one Old Testament. That was his balanced diet for church going. Mine was a little bit more self-centered. Whichever part of the Bible I'm working at seriously at the moment is what I inflicted on the congregation. Because it didn't matter to me which part of the Bible, it was just important that it was the Bible and that I was doing as best I could in expounding it. Now, that's still selection. However, in the selection of the preaching, I think it is important to so read the Bible that the selection you choose reflects the logic of the book that you're preaching through. So to preach verse by verse through the book of Leviticus is most likely not a wise way of understanding Leviticus, let alone teaching a congregation. Even down the other end of the spectrum, I hear people preaching what I call oral commentaries. That is, they feel obliged to mention every verse in the passage. That's failure to see the forest because of the trees. Now, I want to know which of these verses do I need to convey to this congregation what the passage is saying? And sometimes that means I leave out verses 3 and 4 because that's not going to help this congregation to understand this passage. And if I'm running a Bible study, I would use number 3 and 4. But if I'm doing a 25-minute monologue, if I put verse 3 and 4 in, they're not going to understand verses 1 and 5 because of just the structure of preaching a sermon. I just can't do every verse. Now, if I'm writing a commentary, I must explain verses 3 and 4. That's why I call them oral commentaries. They're just not sermons. But I could preach 2 sermons, one leaving verses 3 and 4 out, then the next week preach it with just verses 3 and 4. But I've got to understand how 3 and 4 affects the logic of the passage to get it right. But I may not spend the time on those verses because the hearer will not be able to hear. But yes, you're going to have to leave things out. Selection is a necessity of preaching. What do I choose to leave out and put in? It's got to do with aim. And my aim is trying to find the aim of the passage so that I make that choice from the Bible rather than from my reflection.
There are passages where there might be more than one aim.
Oh, yeah.
You're open to making a choice about what you're going to concentrate on in a particular 25-minute.
I have to make a choice. The person who doesn't make a choice preaches insufferable sermons that will not be heard and understood. Yes. I've got to make the choice.
Yeah.
I want to make the choice as close to the aim of the fundamental main aim of the passage as I understand it as I can. But you're quite right. I can preach 5 sermons on the same passage.
I guess it follows on from that point, but if we are preaching through a book chapter by chapter, as opposed to just trying to find, as we read through the text, finding particular aims, even the aim of the passage may change because you're going through a whole chapter.
Yes, that's right.
The chapter, as opposed to what's the aim of all of that text, as opposed to just the aim of that. And so you're not ignoring parts of the text, you're just not emphasizing them. You're using them still to work out, as I said, what the text is saying.
Yep.
You're telling people that.
I agree with what you're saying there, and it's different. And the way of preaching the synoptics is different, I think, to the way of preaching John's gospel. Because I think John organises his material on a different basis than the synoptics, who put a series of related pericope paragraphs together. They're related, but they are units within themselves. Whereas John has long dialogues, and so I found in preaching John's gospel, I would look for the central verse that could explain the most as a keyhole into the whole chapter, in a way that I wouldn't if I'm going through Mark's gospel, because Mark has, you know, six or seven stories, events about Jesus that have a common theme. So how you preach, you can preach each week, 6 weeks on that chapter of Mark, or you can preach once. When I was doing a university degree back in medieval days, when we had exams, we used to be given in my senior years anyway, a three-hour exam, and there would be 10 questions on the page, and you could choose to write 3, 4, 5, or 6 essays of the 10. In the final year I was in, you could write one if you chose to. But what you wrote then was reflected in the hour time you spent with it. So if you had five questions, six questions, you'd have half an hour at each. Well, it's very hard to get an A on that, a high distinction. But it was very hard to fail you, because you always had something to say for half an hour. But if you chose three, then you had to write for an hour. Well, you had a chance then of getting a distinction, but you also had a much higher chance of getting the whole thing wrong and failing completely. And when you get down to, you know, I'm going to write for 3 hours on one of the 10 subjects, you either got the high distinction in the university medal, or you failed completely in the abysmally. And so preaching the sermon's a little bit like that. You know, give me a big passage, I can tell you some really true, great truths from that passage, but I'm not going to tell you everything. To be able to preach on a little passage, I really have to know what I'm talking about to be able to succeed at doing that. So my general advice to preachers is start in big passages and then learn how to get to smaller passages over time. Because if you've got a big passage, you can at least say 5 things that are right. If you get a little passage, you say 5 things, you've got a good chance that 4 of them are wrong. But I heard Leon Morris, the great Leon Morris, come and preach in our church. And he preached on a phrase. And he was right. But Leon Morris knew the Bible. You know, I couldn't have done what he did. Questions are always quick, it's the answers that are slow.
So doing the aim, like I'm going to use your Corinthians passage as an example, you said that the aim is not talking about female, anything there to do with women, but it's order in the church. How much do you then have to re-educate people about what the main aim is with the elephant in the room that people are just focused on?
Oh, thank you. Yes, that's
so
absolutely.
So you did that with 137, for example. That's not my name about smashing kids against the rocks, but
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's very hard pressed to preach on 1 Corinthians 14, the last section of it, in a world which has been dominated by feminism since the 1970s, and which still to this day is a matter of absolutely hot potato conversation for people. And so to ignore the elephant means they will not be listening to what you're saying. They'll be just hanging out waiting for you to say it about the women. And so in that context, not in this context, but in that context, I'll be saying, you see, this passage here is about the women. It's not. I'm going to talk about that in our congregational meeting, you know, in 3 weeks' time, and come and we'll talk about women, and we'll talk about the whole passage and other passages as well. But for tonight, we're not going to discuss it, because what the passage is about is how we're running church in decency and order. That's the key, and we'll leave that out. But we can't leave it out of being a pastor of a church. So I came to chapter 5 of Matthew's Gospel, I remember, and there's this divorce and remarriage in the part of Sydney I was in. Divorce and remarriage was the order of the day all around about us and within our congregation. So we did two things. One was we went through the congregational role, worked out all the people who are in divorce remarriage situations, and the my dear pastoral friend, Derek, contacted every one of them before the sermon to talk to them about how they would feel about this passage coming up and how they'd feel where they were at. So I was thinking, and most of them said, no, we want Philip just to tell us what this is. They were very happy about it, but nearly all of them were very thankful for Derek's kindness in coming and warning them that this was coming up as the issue of the day. And then we said we'd have another day in which we'd talk about marriage, divorce, and put it separate, so as to help the big aim is to help the minds to hear what the passage is saying. Well, if your emotions are wound up on a subject that's tangential to the passage, you don't hear what's being said. So the job then is, as a pastor, is to get rid of the emotional tangential things. And so, yeah, you can't really preach with an elephant in the room like that. No. Except with you guys, but I did.